think that it will be simple, that cancer is a problem that we can solve with three or four drugs. We feel like we're advancing, and as we advance, it's like we're opening up a series of black boxes. We're bringing in some light, but then the light shows us that a little bit further on, there's another black box. With this new idea, which emphasizes metabolism as an important factor, it is imperative that we not fall prey to the sort of oversimplification that could lead to the same kind of problems and disappointments that we had with the previous paradigms.
It will be important, though, to conduct the proper trials. And those trials will be large. They'll be much larger than the 3,600 patient study we're doing. They could include tens of thousands of individuals.
Why is it taking us so long to implement genuine wide-scale clinical trials for these drugs?
It is possible that the policies of the funding agencies over the last decades have encouraged, for example, gene-oriented research on cancer and have discouraged or slowed down other kinds of research. If somebody would have sent in a grant application on metabolism 20 years ago, they would have had a very hard time justifying why they wanted to work on metabolism.
The government has to almost, at least for the next 20 years, has to set up a special program for metabolism. And I'm being very serious about this because there are not enough people who can judge metabolism. You just have to say, we're going to put a certain amount of the budget and the people who know metabolism will help us decide, and we're going to try to encourage other people to get into it.
But I'm afraid right now there is a lot of conservatism, and there is not enough money. And there are a lot of scientists out there. And they want papers, they want quick answers, and there is huge competition. And the kind of experiments we do takes a long time. And not very many people are as stubborn as I am. We need people to have the courage of their conviction.
It's crucial to continue taking an empirical approach. Look, we built boats long before we had any understanding of how boats are able to float and move. In the same way, we need to use empirical methods, that is, conduct clinical trials when dealing with cancer. And that's the work of physicians. We've had a lot of progress in treating cancer, even though we still don't really understand why. So through the empirical approach, huge advances have been made through the trials we've done, through our errors and observations. Hopefully this will continue, and as we acquire a better understanding of what is going on, our results will improve.
When the science is strong enough that the scientific community feels it is valid to test the benefits of these drugs, we need to make it easier for future studies to be initiated and for future investigators to get the funding that they need. And that's the challenge in this area. It's not a scientific challenge, it's a societal challenge.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime army has imposed yet more restrictions on the Palestinians of Al-Khalil, especially in the Old City, to facilitate the passage of settlers to the Ibrahimi Mosque. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "The name Al-Khalil immediately evokes the tight military grip that the Zionist regime has imposed on the Palestinian city for many years in order to protect 400 illegal Zionist settlers who have occupied the heart of the city since 1990s. Yet for months, the Israeli regime army has imposed yet more restrictions on the Palestinians of Al-Khalil, especially in the Old City, to facilitate the passage of settlers to the Ibrahimi Mosque. The city area is divided and fragmented by hundreds of military checkpoints. 120 were erected by the Zionist regime around the mosque alone. Residents have to pass through them and endure all kinds of humiliation, while Zionist settlers have their comfortable streets and are not subjected to any kind of harassment. The Zionist settlers claim that the complex where the Ibrahimi Mosque is located, which they refer to as the Cave of the Patriarchs, belongs to them." In 1994, a far-right American Zionist settler carried out a massacre in the mosque during the month of Ramadan, killing 29 Muslim worshippers and injuring dozens more. Since then, Zionist settlers have taken control of half of the complex. Moreover, the fabricated regime of Israel divided the old city, sealed off entire streets, and closed more than 1,000 shops, which were considered the beating heart of the city. Many Palestinians who lived in the center of the city were forced to leave their homes at gunpoint by Israeli regime troops and settlers. Those who refuse to leave have been subjected to all sorts of harassment and racist practices throughout the years. Several neighborhoods in the city, such as Tel Romeida, Al-Shohada Street, and Al-Salamiya and Jaber, are considered a microcosm of the larger context of suffering experienced by Palestinians due to Israeli occupation. Aref Jaber, 59, has lived in the Jaber neighborhood his entire life. Jaber witnessed the radical change that took place during the 1990s and told the Palestine Chronicle that Israel imposed even more severe restrictions over the last few months. Jaber said, "This neighborhood was connected to the Ibrahimi Mosque and we used to walk there before the infamous massacre in 1994. In parallel with its aggression against the Gaza Strip, the Zionist regime has increased its brutality against Palestinians in the West Bank, tightening its grip on them and restricting their movements even more. The Jaber neighborhood is inhabited by 5,000 Palestinians who are surrounded by several Israeli regime military checkpoints. They cannot leave their homes, let alone move freely at night. Otherwise, they would be subjected to arrest, abuse, and even torture. Checkpoint 160 is one of the most oppressive Israeli regime military checkpoints. Young Palestinian men who pass through checkpoint 160 are subjected to repeated searches and are often forced to remove their clothes and stand there for hours, handcuffed without any justification by the Israeli regime authorities. Jaber explained, "We are also subjected to unannounced curfews. When the evening comes, Israeli troops begin wandering the streets of the neighborhood, and if they see a Palestinian, even a woman, they abduct and abuse them for hours. In addition, Israeli regime troops, without any reason, routinely fire tear gas and sound bombs at Palestinian homes just for fun. When cases of suffocation are reported, ambulances are not allowed to enter the neighborhood. The restrictions of movement also extend to Palestinians who need to reach hospitals. Israeli regime troops carry out thorough inspections and harass them, preventing ambulances from transporting patients and even pregnant women who are in labor." Jaber said, "It's like living in hell. During Ramadan, it is as if we are in prison." He continued, "We cannot visit each other and we are forced to stay at home most of the time to avoid Israeli occupation troops who are deployed in large numbers." Zionist settlers in Al-Khalil have inflicted all sorts of abuse on Palestinian residents to force them to leave in order to seize the remaining homes and facilities of the Palestinians. Hisham Al-Sharbati is a member of Al-Khalil Defense Committee. He told the Palestine Chronicle that Israel imposed a tight curfew on the already restricted Old City since the beginning of its aggression against the Gaza Strip on October 7th. Recently, the Zionist regime military has allowed residents to leave their homes at specific hours. However, Palestinians continue to be subjected to harassment by Zionist troops and settlers deployed across the area. Al-Sharbati explained, "According to the new regulations imposed by the Israeli army, residents of this area are allowed to leave their homes at a certain hour, but they cannot return during the day. They must wait for a specific hour in the evening. The entrances to the Old City leading to the Ibrahimi Mosque are all closed and only residents of the adjacent houses are allowed to enter the complex. But they too are subjected to hours of humiliation at the Israeli regime military checkpoints." Recently, Israeli regime authorities began preventing Palestinians from using the cemetery inside the Old City. Therefore, the residents are forced to obtain a special permit to bury the dead there. Al-Sharbati said, "During the last Jewish holiday, settlers attacked a Palestinian funeral, beat the mourners and expelled them, forcing them to search for alternative cemeteries outside the Old City. The true goal of these brutal practices is clear. Israel wants to force the Palestinian population to leave their city. The families who decided to remain in this area, however, are refusing to surrender to the relentless humiliation and restrictions. They are determined to stay and preserve the original Palestinian identity of the city."
black and white.
Recientemente, en El Salvador.
Recently, in El Salvador, a country in Central America which has 6.5 million inhabitants,
de los cuales un 30% está,
of which 30% are in absolute poverty and 70% live in informality,
que gran parte de su PBI,
and a large part of its GDP is based on what is the contributions made by immigrants. General elections on the presidency and other levels of direction of the state have been held.
Elecciones presidenciales y también de otros niveles al Estado, a la dirección del Estado. En las presidenciales, Bukele.
In the presidential elections, Bukele has been elected by 82.6%. That is what the hegemonic press and general communicate around the world.
La prensa hegemónico y hegemónica en general tiró por el mundo. La verdad de que eso corresponde.
The truth is that this corresponds to 52% of the voters, of the people with the right to vote.
Lo que de los votantes. De las personas con derecho a voto.
48% abstained and did not participate.
No participó. Es decir, Bukele tiene aproximadamente.
That is to say, Bukele has approximately 80% of half of the Salvadorian electorate. That is the real result and not what is presented as a success in which the entire people turned to vote mostly for Bukele.
Que todo el pueblo se volcó a votar mayoritariamente por Bukele.
Bukele is a rather strange character.
En su tiempo,
in his time, it was said that he preferred the left 1,000 times over the right. Today he meets the extreme right leaders in the world, and he himself is one of them.
De ultraderecha en el mundo. Hace pocos días tuvo una reunión internacional con Trump, con Bolsonaro.
A few days ago, he was at the international meeting with Trump, with Bolsonaro, with Milei, with Duke, among others, to express his successful policy of eliminating gangs and developing El Salvador.
Y desarrollo de El Salvador.
A development that does not exist anywhere. Though Bukele has always made many promises. He has made promises, for example, to build 4 universities in his first mandate. He didn't build them.
No las construyó. Ahora, mira, hizo una promesa.
Now at least he made a promise to build a Bitcoin city. Such a city never existed. A high-speed train that never existed.
Un tren bala que nunca existió.
But he did build the largest prison of all in Latin America.
Más grande de toda América Latina. Bukele, aprovechando el tema de.
Bukele took advantage of the issue of gangs, which were born in the United States at a time when the country was in an internal war. Where the forces of Farabundo Martí, National Liberation Front, were trying to take power and build a new society, since the country practically did not exist.
Donde la represión.
The repression of the state with the support of North American Marines was such that 10% of the Salvadorian population went to the United States. That is almost 500,000 people. At that time, El Salvador had a population of 4,900,000 people.
Luego Estados Unidos.
The gangs were formed there, then the United States detained more than 5,000 and sent them back to El Salvador, to a place where young people had nothing to do but to join with these prophets who arrived to offer them some opportunity to survive.
Profetas que llegaban a ofrecer alguna oportunidad para subsistir. Eso es lo que ha manejado Bukele.
That is what Bukele has managed. Deception, repression. and he has taken advantage of the gang phenomenon created by the system itself. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. Hoy, desde San Salvador, El Salvador, estamos con Walter.
Today, we're with Walter Rottles from Salvador, El Salvador, author, journalist, university professor, and manager of an independent media.
Autor también de libros como Ni Militar Ni Sacerdote.
Walter is also the author of books such as Neither a Soldier Nor a Priest, The Fate of Amoy, and Against the Power of Communication of the Excluded. He was the host of Venceremos, the official radio channel of the Farabundo Martí Front for National Liberation during the armed conflict. Walter, welcome to Black and White.
Walter Raudales a Negro y Blanco.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you from here in El Salvador to try to make sense of this very obscure reality on social media. Undoubtedly, there are many aspects that can only be clarified by those of us who actually live in El Salvador. Thank you very much and hello to you all.
Gracias a ti, Walter. Mira, desde...
Thank you, Walter. In our countries, for example in Chile and other countries, when we see the news of Latin America, they emphasize the great victory of Bukele and usually talk about the suppression of gangs and say that this has made the people very happy in general.
A las pandillas y que eso tiene a la población en general muy contenta. Yeah. Eso es lo que se habla.
This is what they are talking about. Anyway, before you answer me, it's good to give you a little introduction about the time before 2018 or 2019 when Bukele came to power for his first term as president.
2019 ya cuando asume la primera ¿cómo se llama? Presidencia Bukele.
What were the previous conditions? What allowed him to emerge as a political figure? We know that he changed the political position because everything tells us that at that time he was aligned with the Farabundo Martí Front.
Porque todo nos dice, cierto, que estaba ligado al Frente Farabundo Martí en su momento.
Bueno, lo que pasa es que no podemos dar por hecho eso.
Yes, we cannot assume this for certain. There are many facts and lies. So we need to specify these two things. In El Salvador, we have a situation similar to what Charles Dickens said in the book Two Cities. He says that we are in the best of worlds and in the worst of worlds at the same time. Later, the best of the worlds turned out to be the digital world, the great digital armies that here are in the service of the current government of President Bukele. The number of people and the production form of his virtual mobs or trolls have been exposed. As a result, here there is a machine. On the other hand, the worst of worlds is the real world. According to the United Nations World Food Program, poverty has increased in El Salvador. When this government came to power, poverty rate stood at 19%. This percentage has increased significantly, and today we are talking about a very high percentage of people. We have a population of 6.5 million, and the World Food Program estimates that 1.8 and almost 2 million people live in El Salvador who are on the verge of starvation. So there are a lot of lies. When it comes to media, you have to be able to analyze very well, otherwise you can get it wrong. Look, previous governments, even the right-wing governments from the Nationalist Republican Alliance, ARENA, tried to somehow negotiate with the gangs. Leaked information indicates that they had contacts to establish some kind of agreement with these gangs. The first FMLN government, the left-leaning Farabundo Martí Front for National Liberation with Mauricio Funes, attempted to negotiate with the gangs. There was talk of a famous agreement, and they negotiated with the gangs, and even the Organization of American States entered the process. At that time, there was a lot of violence in the streets and throughout the country. When Bukele came to office, he had secret and non-public negotiations with the gangs. This issue was revealed in the audio files that were released. They never published it publicly. Under previous administrations, approximately 10 of the 14 main gang leaders were jailed. Here, they're called ranfla, which is considered as a main committee with the management of gangs. Due to the crimes committed by these prisoners in America, the issue of their extradition to America was raised. At this time, the current government, in a judicial coup, dissolved the Supreme Court of Justice and the Constitutional Court and imposed a new Supreme Court of Justice. This work is referred to as a judicial coup. At this time, in May 2021, the legislature came into action and virtually all extradition proceedings were halted, and this administration agreed with the gang leaders not to extradite them to America. So, how can there be a fight against the gangs when you agree with the gangs not to extradite them in exchange for a reduction in murders? In addition, a very important news was published here, and that was the release of the third leader of these gangs, who is known as Crook. He was released from prison by a government agent. That government agent takes him to a luxury apartment hotel for one night. He takes him to Guatemala, arms him, and lets him through. America arrests him in Mexico. Crook's trial made everyone here very angry because he disclosed important things there. So there is a secret negotiation with the gangs.
We are going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with Walter Raudewals in a few minutes. We continue with Walter Raudewals. We were saying that there are a series of statistics that are sometimes manipulated and not accurate. These statistics are about crimes. Continue, please.
Adelante, por favor.
Bueno, entonces, mi planteamiento es que esta...
So what I'm suggesting is that this apparent reduction is a fragile peace based on a secret agreement with the gangs, which has now been exposed. This agreement will have many consequences because when this agreement is lost, this issue is known as mafia peace. This issue has been widely reposted on social media. So I also said that the best of worlds is in social media and the worst of the worlds is in the reality, because this situation raises the main issues such as crime, which is in a very bad condition. Poverty and hunger in El Salvador are concealed and may not be apparent in social media. El Salvador does not produce as much as it consumes and has to import. El Salvador's economy basically revolves around $7 billion in income that El Salvadorians send to their relatives in the form of remittances from America and communities far from El Salvador's homeland in Canada and Europe. This is their only support. Foreign investment has fallen since the time of coronavirus and has not yet returned to its previous state. Some large garment production workshops that existed in the textile industry are gone. Agriculture has been completely damaged, so the country is run only by remittances. El Salvador exports people. Many of our brothers are forced to flee because there are no living facilities. What I'm suggesting is that we have the best world in the digital space and social networks, but the worst world in real life. As a result, we have two versions of El Salvador here. I want to delve into this issue more deeply. To understand this element conceptually, note that Bukele is an American laboratory. When I say America, I mean its imperial position. They're working with different gangs and they're getting results. They get results because they are people outside the political system and model. They take advantage of the weakness of political parties, corruption, and unacceptability. but they simply embellish this unfavorable situation and support it with new technologies and social networks. They gain attractiveness and create interesting characters using their powers. An example is Javier Milei in Argentina. Ecuador is another example. So imperialism is proposing and testing various models, and it has achieved its desired result in El Salvador. According to this explanation, in Argentina and almost in the same way in Ecuador, they want to control these countries with this method.
Walter, in the same context, American imperialism and the West in general created Daesh in West Asia as a way to destabilize everything and intervene, and as we all know, to implement its own policy. It seems that here the issue of drug trafficking, gangs and crime and security are issues that are always not topics in the hegemonic media. And they talk about crime every day. People want their lives to be protected, and the eyes are directed towards the governments that you mentioned at the end of your speech. And that's how we find out about Noboa and Milei. We see how governments are becoming police states and how public liberties are being eroded. How is this in El Salvador today?
¿Cómo está eso hoy día en El Salvador?
Bueno, en El Salvador se aprobó un régimen de excepción.
Well, in El Salvador, a state of emergency was passed that takes away all constitutional guarantees and rights. March 28 marks 3 years of this emergency status. In this extraordinary situation, they can arrest you on the street. They will take you to the jail and you have no rights. You don't have even the right to defend yourself because they hold the brief trial for 300 prisoners. International and human rights organizations have constantly complained about this shameless violation of human rights. So there's an extraordinary situation that allows the police, the soldiers of the armed forces and the military to arrest people on the street and even arrest you in your own home. Therefore, the most basic rights, such as the right to respect the place of residence, freedom of movement, etc., have been lost in this extraordinary situation. And we have been in this awful situation for 3 years now.
Walter, this is how I understand that there are over 65,000 prisoners, and of course over 8,000 were forced to be released because they were taken without charge. And they also say that the leaders of labor unions and the people who have been arrested, some of them were arrested at their place of work due to non-payment of damages and similar reasons.
Mire, es terrible, digamos, es terrible, es un régimen de terror, es un régimen de terror.
The situation is dire, it is dire. It's a regime of intimidation, a regime of intimidation. I cannot verify these numbers because the permission to enter the prisons has not been given to the international bodies that carry out the work of verification. There's a very large prison with gang members that they say is the cathedral of gangs. Because one of the provisions of the contract is to create a special prison for them. Most people are in the shadow of prison. We are talking about 70,000 people, but this is the information they give. At first, they deny that they had arrested innocent people. There is a movement of innocent victims of the regime called Movir. They are constantly providing information. The latest information is that until now, more than 270 people have died in prison under torture. No one gives you information. There is no process for this in the courts. It is better to say that there is no law in this matter. Worst of all, the arrest is done in a special way. They have set a quota for the policemen and they have to bring a number of people as prisoners daily. Therefore, they give leave to policemen and soldiers according to the number of people. This is a confidential matter and a terrible violation of human rights. Those who have been released speak of the horrific torture inside the prisons, which are considered crimes against humanity. But in addition, there is a media barracks that say this is a successful process and a successful model that is being practiced around the world. They do these using their media arms, their huge digital armies. It is clear that they will take away any possibility of citizenship from you. During 1 hour, they can put a sentence, an idea, and a thought in the minds of the Salvadorians. Do you know what the government's main campaign motto was during the presidential and regional elections? The main message was this: if you vote against the government, they will release the gang members. This is a message of fear.
Yes,
that's right, Walter. Wait, you know what's interesting? How do you assess the results of the elections? Because here we discussed only the percentage of votes of the participants in the elections. 82.7% or something like that. About 48% of the population did not participate in the elections.
Se abstuvo de votar como un 48%.
Acaban de pasar acá dos elecciones, la del 3 de febrero, que fue presidencial.
Two elections were held here on February 3, presidential and parliamentary elections. Elections turnout was 52%, that is 48% did not participate. Municipalities, regions and members of the Central American Parliament. It was an incredible historical issue because 70% did not participate in this election. There is only talk of the 30% who have participated. They committed fraud in the presidential election because according to the Constitution, the president cannot be re-elected and this is prohibited. Therefore, the mere issue of the president's nomination was a fraud. The entire organizational structure was in favor of this issue and eventually people have the impression that a fraud has occurred. I will give you a concrete example. When they opened the ballot boxes, there were unfolded votes. I mean, there were voting papers that were not folded. How can they enter that box but not fold it? These papers had to be folded several times to pass through that groove and enter the box. How can there be unfolded votes in the boxes? They were marked with pens other than the official pens of the elections. As a result, the impression that exists among the people now is that there has been an elections fraud and they have not been able to change it with all their media power.
Yes, it is. Walter, we're dealing with fraud and repression. We're faced with unfulfilled promises, for example, four universities that were supposed to be built, but were never realized. El Salvador has become the most brutal prison in Latin America. This is Black and White. Thank you.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
And New York judge has imposed a gag order on Donald Trump, limiting the former president from making statements about potential witnesses in a criminal trial relating to hush money payments. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The judge overseeing the criminal case against former President Donald Trump in New York imposed a gag order on Tuesday, 26th of March, restricting what Trump can say about those involved in the upcoming trial, which revolves around a hush money payment made to a film actress in 2016. Judge Juan Merchan issued the order limiting Donald Trump's public statements in response to a February request from Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, whose office listed a series of statements that Trump had made relating to multiple cases in making the request. Judge Juan Merchan said the examples went far beyond defending himself against attacks by public figures. He described Donald Trump's statements as threatening, inflammatory, and denigrating, with the targets of his statements either assigned to the cases or performing their civic duty. Alvin Bragg's office had cited statements that Trump made during another New York case, a civil fraud trial that recently ended with a $464 million judgment against him and other defendants. During that trial, Donald Trump publicly attacked a key witness in both cases and was subjected to a gag order for maligning the judge's clerk. The consequences of those statements included not only fear on the part of the individual targeted, but also the assignment of increased security resources to investigate threats and protect the individuals and family members involved, Judge Juan Merchan wrote. The order bars Trump from commenting or causing others to comment on potential witnesses in the case, prospective jurors, court staff, lawyers in the district attorney's office, and the relatives of any counsel or court staffer. He's allowed to criticize Alvin Bragg himself, as well as Judge Juan Merchan. The case is scheduled to go to trial on 15th of April. Trump mentioned Judge Juan Merchan's adult daughter in a social media post on Tuesday morning, decrying her work for a Democratic consulting firm. Trump's lawyers in 2023 argued that Judge Merchan should step down from the case, an effort that Judge Merchan rejected. Trump is charged with falsifying business records related to reimbursements for a $130,000 payment to film actress Stormy Daniels in the days before the 2016 presidential election. Judge Juan Merchan emphasized the urgency of imposing the gag order before the trial begins, citing a pattern of threats and intimidation that has accompanied Donald Trump's other cases. He noted how the nature and impact of Trump's statements about his federal election interference case in Washington, D.C., prompted the judge in that matter to issue a similar gag order. Judge Merchan wrote that such prior statements establish a sufficient risk to the administration of justice. Given that the eve of the trial is upon us, it is without question that the imminent risk of harm is now paramount, the judge wrote. The order limits what Donald Trump can say about some of his most frequent targets. His former fixer and lawyer, Michael Cohen, is a key witness in the case, and he is a vehement Trump critic. The former president has derided him as a sleazebag. Donald Trump now risks violating the order if he lobs similar insults at Michael Cohen in the lead-up to the trial. Cohen thanked the judge for imposing the gag order, telling CBS News that he has been under relentless assault from Donald's MAGA supporters, while predicting that Trump will seek to defy the gag order by employing others within his circle to do his bidding. Trump is also barred from publicly commenting on counsel in the cases other than Alvin Bragg. Speaking to the press after a hearing in the case on Monday, Trump called one prosecutor in Alvin Bragg's office, Matthew Colangelo, a radical. Trump has frequently mentioned Colangelo's previous work for the Justice Department in his social media posts. CNN cable news network has also covered this story. A New York judge has imposed a gag order on Donald Trump, limiting the former president from making statements about potential witnesses in the criminal trial relating to hush money payments scheduled to begin next month. Judge Juan Merchan also said that Donald Trump can't make statements about attorneys, court staff, or the family members of prosecutors or lawyers intended to interfere with the case. Trump is also barred from making statements about any potential or actual juror. The former president, Judge Juan Merchan wrote, has a history of making threatening, inflammatory, and denigrating statements against people at all levels of the justice system, including jurors. The ruling will prevent Donald Trump from criticizing his former attorney, Michael Cohen, or Stormy Daniels, who are both expected to be witnesses at the trial. The order does not prevent Donald Trump from talking about New York District Attorney Alvin Bragg, who is a public figure, or Judge Juan Merchan himself. The gag order comes as Trump has repeatedly attacked the District Attorney's case and those involved with it ahead of what would be the first criminal trial of a former president. Trump criticized Judge Merchan, his daughter, and one of Alvin Bragg's prosecutors in the hours before Judge Merchan issued his gag order. The uncontested record reflecting the defendant's prior extrajudicial statements establishes a sufficient risk to the administration of justice, and there exists no less restrictive means to prevent such risk, Judge Merchan wrote on Tuesday, 26th of March. Donald Trump's historic criminal trial will begin with jury selection on 15th of April, after a dispute over the late production of documents caused by Judge Merchan to initially push back the start date. Trump is charged with 34 counts of falsifying business records stemming from reimbursements to Michael Cohen for hush money payments he made before the 2016 presidential elections to Stormy Daniels. The district attorney's office had requested the gag order last month to remain in place for the duration of the trial. Trump and his attorneys have argued that as the leading Republican candidate for president, Donald Trump's speech should not be restricted as he appeals to voters in the 2024 election.
Yani.
Bazaar.
Historically, humans lived a colourful and adventurous hunter-gatherer lifestyle. But what brought humans into the valleys and grasslands, and later into a collective society? Some argue wheat domesticated mankind, settling humans permanently next to their fields. Humans have come a long way from traditional farming. Presently, some 38% of the Earth's surface is used to cultivate crops. Technology has revolutionized agricultural production, leading to more food security worldwide.
Oh, hello there. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This time, we will explore the agriculture industry. We shine the spotlight on the marriage between technology and science for high-yield agricultural productions. We wanted to see how the agricultural sector is developing new ways to increase the efficiency of natural resource use, while also elevating the quality of cultivated food. Well, let's not waste any time. Let's walk through the fields of today's bazaar.
Our quest for answers led us to a company in Khorasan Razavi province that specializes in livestock rearing and potato cultivation. Khozai is a family business handed down to four generations over the years. It has some 2,400 hectares of farmland where saffron, Mohammadi roses, potatoes and wheat are cultivated. This company has spent years perfecting a cultivation system using its own agrotechie, enabling it to enhance the performance of mini-tubers. So what is a mini-tuber? They are the first generation of nuclear miniature seed potatoes. These can be engineered to have disease-free characteristics and are bred to shorten field cycles, leading to high harvest yields of healthy potatoes. The beating heart of this company is its research and development department. This is where production actually begins. This company has several varieties of potatoes in vitro tissue culture form that are subject to rigorous disease testing. This ensures the company starts cultivation with the highest quality tissue cultures. After lab tests, the plant material is transferred to hydroponic greenhouses and later taken to the field for mass production.
You might be wondering why some farmers choose hydroponic methods over others. It's a soilless system where roots are kept in a dark environment saturated with an aerosol of nutrient-rich solution. This way, cultivators can observe the entire plant structure and strictly control production phases. Plus, this high-tech method gives cultivators unique insight into specific plant characteristics that can assist with field production.
As we mentioned earlier, this company also specializes in raising sheep and cows for meat and dairy production. It's interesting to know how potato production led to livestock rearing. The founder and director of the company shares his experience with us. After the mini tubes are raised in greenhouses, a portion of them is stored in refrigerated rooms for later use. Other storage facilities hold potato seeds and harvested products, which are later released into the market. It is no surprise that this company has received three consecutive national awards for being a top producer of livestock and agricultural products. Much of its success is attributed to a large amount of science and knowledge used for production. This company employs expert staff and researchers who also play a significant role in the company's dynamic progress. As part of its future vision, this company is eyeing expansion. It is already working on launching a botany clinic and other food-related laboratories. This company takes a great deal of pride in its socially responsible productions. It has spent decades trying to optimize its use of natural resources and make organic and nutritious products.
The company we just mentioned is just one example of how the agricultural industry is expanding with the help of modern technology. Iran produces tons of agricultural products annually, which it also exports to destinations abroad. The food industry is also heavily dependent on this sector as it plays a critical role in the country's food security and national economy.
Iran has a total area of 165 million hectares of land. Of this amount, 50 million hectares are arable farmlands. Moreover, some 21,000 hectares are dedicated to greenhouse farming. Iran's agriculture makes up around 8% of the national GDP. Plus, it employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. The country's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports in 2020. Data from Iran's Customs Administration shows that Iran exported over $800 million worth of agricultural products from April through May this year. Additionally, figures showed over 1.7 million tons of these products were sold to foreign markets during that period. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list were pistachios. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture, aquaculture, and livestock products also raked in millions in foreign exchange. Industry analysts say there has been a relative decline in exports compared to the same two-month period last year. They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging, and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines, and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less-than-average rainfall coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian. It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules. These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion, meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation. It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts.